Our next case, 11-131, Disciplinary Council versus Lawson.
Chief Justice O'Connor and members of the court, may it please the court. I am Dave Greer from Dayton, and I'm here representing Ken Lawson, who is a former lawyer from Cincinnati. Have you ever taken a flight from point A to point B, where somewhere along that flight path, the plane hit an air pocket and just had a free fall? If you're lucky, the thing leveled out when it hit bottom and proceeded on its path. I think that phenomenon is illustrative of the fascinating story of Ken Lawson. It's a sad story, but it's a fascinating story, and there's a heartwarming part to it. Ken was the first African-American lawyer to become a lawyer at the venerable Cincinnati firm of Taft, Stettinius, and Hollister. He decided to be a champion of the ethnically and economically deprived section of his city of Cincinnati and went on his own. He rose to the top of the Cincinnati trial bar. He was admired and respected. He gave endless pro bono time to the city's underprivileged citizens. He represented over and over again an unrepresented or underrepresented portion of that community. He represented those citizens in what became a divisive civic war with the Cincinnati Police Department and helped achieve a solution for the benefit of his community. Ken tore a rotator cuff bench pressing at an exercise place. He was prescribed Percodan. He continued to take it. He became hopelessly addicted to it. It ruined his life. He went through a disciplinary proceeding. I represent him in that. I've now represented him in three. This is the third pro bono proceeding I've represented Mr. Lawson in. He admitted his wrongdoing from January 1st of 2007, after he had hit the bottom of that air pocket. He has been an exemplary citizen. He has devoted himself completely to his own rehabilitation, which he has effectively done. He has been drug-free since January of 2007. He has devoted his life to helping people who are addicted to alcohol or drugs, and has personally been of great help to all of those people he has touched.
And what is he doing now as far as employment?
He is presently, after he came out of the penitentiary, mm-hmm. He did his probation work in Hawaii, where his wife is paying off her debt for her medical school by working in the slums of Hawaii in a hospital. He's not there on a grand vacation watching whales. He became involved, as he had been involved in Cincinnati prior to his incarceration. He became involved in lecturing to law students and others on substance abuse issues. The testimony is that he has been a riveting lecturer and has been of great assistance in those programs in Hawaii. He has also been engaged as a non-lawyer working with the Innocence Project at the University of Hawaii Law School. And those who have seen him in that capacity sing his praises.
So you're before us asking that the your client receive an indefinite suspension with the hope of reestablishing his standing as a lawyer at some time?
Absolutely. He has conceded every relevant fact. The facts have been found. I'm not challenging any facts that are found. As you know from my briefs, I'm presenting four, what I think are interesting legal issues that are not fact-intensive issues in this case particularly.
Is he currently on probation?
I am not sure whether he's completed his probation or not. I believe that he's either completed or almost done with it.
And our information before us is that he successfully dealt with the issues in the criminal justice system, is engaged in substance abuse treatment, counseling, et cetera, and I'm presuming, based on what you just mentioned, is gainfully active in his community.
That is correct, as I understand it, Your Honor.
If I understand, Mr. Greer, is your client currently indefinitely suspended from the practice of law?
He is. He was indefinitely suspended in, I think, June or July of 2008.
And that results from activity beginning in 2003, unrelated to the chemical dependency problem?
No, Your Honor, it does not. Everything, the finding and the reason that I think there are interesting issues of claim and issue preclusion in this case that are legal issues, and also issues of concurrent as opposed to consecutive indefinite suspensions, and issues of whether prior conduct should be considered an aggravating circumstance in the present situation. What was found in that first disciplinary proceeding, and it was a proper finding, was that he had engaged in a pervasive and devastating, those are the words that were used, pattern of misconduct which arose from his chemical dependency. He did horrendous things that nobody should do. He did them because he was a drug addict.
And that involved clients of the law firm?
Absolutely. It involved clients, courts. Were it not for his chemical dependency, Mr. Lawson would have been disbarred in 2008. But the pattern that was devastating and pervaded every aspect of his conduct when he was desperately trying to get money to buy more drugs, that's what he was doing. No question about it. The pattern of conduct back then.
So the chemical dependency led to the abuse of the clients, and that resulted in the indefinite suspension issued by our court.
That is correct.
And then this matter arises from the felony conviction for the either trafficking or obtaining the Oxycontin or Percodin?
I submit to the court, and your question gets right to the crux of why I'm here today. This proceeding relates to exactly the same pervasive, devastating pattern of conduct. At the time of that last proceeding, it was known to everyone involved, and it was part of the record that his primary drug supplier was Dr. Broadnax, that a guy named George Beatty was the street supplier of drugs for him, and that he was there was a Cincinnati police and federal and criminal investigation ongoing at the time.
But that wasn't a charge in the first round back in July of 08. That wasn't the substance of that suspension, correct?
You're absolutely right, because he had not been, they waited until he got suspended to file a criminal charge against
him. There's a distinction and I don't know whether there, what I hear you arguing is that it all should have been bundled into one grievance and it should have been dealt with back in the bundle that happened in, that resulted in the order of July 9th, 2008. That order only addressed his representation of 13 clients, the settlement funds that were stolen, misuse of his IOLTA, and the other things that happened, during that period of time. what you're saying, that he was doing all this other illegal drug activity at the same time, and that should have been addressed.
Absolutely.
But whether it should have or it could have at that point, there's no obligation to do that.
That's why I think the legal question before this court, one of the key legal questions, is the question of claim and issue preclusion. All that information was available at the time, and if you go to the Grava case, which we have cited, which is on the subject of claim preclusion, what happens is if they're the same parties, yes, they're the same parties. Did it arise out of the...
Was that a disciplinary case?
It was not a disciplinary case, although in the Weaver case, which was a disciplinary case, it was certainly held that those same principles of claim and issue preclusion are applicable to disciplinary cases. I can't see any logical, legal, or ethical reason why they should not be.
Well, he wasn't indicted, nor was he convicted at the time in July of 2009, was he?
He was not, but an indictment, Your Honor, is simply a piece of paper that relates to facts. A conviction is simply a judicial resolution that relates to facts, and all of the facts that are relevant are part of the pervasive and devastating pattern of drug-related facts.
What were the crimes that he was convicted of?
He was convicted of one crime, of fraudulently obtaining prescription drugs for his own use. Same crime that you can read in the paper every day ends up in treatment in lieu of conviction for most people.
I think what the Chief Justice is trying to address is that the first indefinite suspension related to conduct involving clients of the law firm in terms of mishandling affairs and finances, and this matter relates to a criminal conviction. Your argument is, I think, because it all arises from the same activity, I guess you're asking us not to consider the conviction, or what are you asking us?
I'm asking you to consider that the difference is a distinction without a real difference, because the fact pattern is the same in this case as it was in the preceding disciplinary
case. Well, then my
case.
Question is, what would you have us do with this? Dismiss it?
I would think you can do one of two things.
We can do a lot of things up here.
Well, I understand that. You asked me what I think. I'll give you two alternatives.
All right,
fine.
Fair enough. Take them both.
Here's what I would suggest is the appropriate thing to do. Either you apply the concepts of claim and issue preclusion, and you end this proceeding by saying it's barred by res judicata, essentially, because of what happened in the prior proceeding. The Weaver case was dramatically different. That was somebody who was acquitted in a criminal proceeding and tried to use the criminal proceeding as a bar to a disciplinary proceeding. Different parties, different burdens of proof. That's not my contention here. My contention is that the prior finding, which was this pattern of pervasive and egregious conduct, what we have here is simply part of that. So the alternative to simply an outright dismissal of this grievance and leaving in place, obviously, his indefinite suspension. He's got mountains to climb before he's ever going to get back in the practice of law. He owes a lot of money. He's not making much of any money. He can't get back into the practice without going through that process, obviously. The alternative would be to say that since this conduct, not the conviction or the indictment, but the conduct that relates to them, since this happened back in the same period prior to January of 2007, that this should be a concurrent suspension rather than a consecutive suspension.
When was he released from prison?
He was released from prison last spring sometime.
So spring of 10?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
How much time has he served on the present suspension? If it runs consecutive, what would the
It would be some June in 11 before he would be eligible to reapply, but obviously he can't. He would have served 3 years by June of 2011. It's been 4.5 years that he's been drug-free, and...
But his present, the present indefinite, has been in effect how long?
The present indefinite suspension was put into effect, I'm sorry, it was on July the 9th of 2008, so 9, 10, 11, mid-July of 2011, he would technically be eligible for applying for reinstatement.
So you're asking us to, if we said this one was concurrent, it would be over before it started.
That's conceivably true. That's quite right. And I we can parse all the various cases on concurrent and consecutive.
But if we said consecutive or here it's by consecutive, the time would start to run, wouldn't it, when his 2 years?
Yeah, let's assume the decision in this came down in sometime in the summer of 2011. That would mean he could not reapply for admission until sometime in 2014, at which point he would have been drug-free, out of the practice, acting as an excellent citizen.
2014.
2 years.
Two years.
2 years, I'm sorry.
And okay.
In any event...
Counsel, you've used your time. You're over your time, so...
I expect that I am. I expect I've probably said all that I can hope to say on behalf of my client, and I appreciate your attention.
Thank you. Mr. Berger.
Mr. Berger, with respect to concurrent, consecutive, Mr. Greer indicated that... his client still owes a lot of money. I take it he's referring to monies that he was responsible for taking from clients or from others or from the law firm. What is that?
At this point in time, the respondent, I believe, is under orders in the prior case to make some restitution. I also believe there's been a couple $100,000 worth of awards made by the client security fund that are normally required to be paid prior to reinstatement, besides the costs of the prior proceeding
so
in the current. Well,
that's what I'm getting at. The reality is, and Mr. Greer has indicated that he's doesn't earn a lot of money, although his wife is a physician, apparently not earning a lot of money either, that under any circumstance, if he didn't get anything today, he wouldn't have a shot at getting back in until all those monies are repaid. Under the way we ordinarily handle things and based on the prior orders of the court.
That would be correct,
right.
Your Honor.
So he's looking at a fairly long wait unless he wins the lottery.
That would be correct, Your Honor, although today Relator is requesting that the court overrule the board's recommendation
right,
of a consecutive indefinite suspension and order that he be permanently disbarred.
Right. I understand that.
Relator offers two primary grounds for the request for permanent disbarment. First, the respondent's extensive and pervasive pattern of misconduct that harmed both clients and the public. Second, this court's prior case law supports disbarment. With regard to the respondent's prior conduct.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, Mr. Greer mentioned this, and I found it interesting that he said, you know, he probably deserved to be disbarred at the first disciplinary proceedings, and but for the substance abuse, which this court takes into consideration in these issues, he received an indefinite suspension, correct?
It was a 4-3 decision with three justices voting for disbarment. That's correct,
okay,
Your Honor.
So we have criminal activity, which was ongoing at the time, I think everybody acknowledges. It was still committed and done within the time frame that he was drug dependent and, you know, had these issues with substance abuse. Why should we not devote the same amount of consideration that precipitated the indefinite on the egregious offenses of the earlier disciplinary case and apply that same consideration to this case and be satisfied with an indefinite suspension? What's different for us today?
Your Honor, there is a line of cases by this court where this court has held that a chemical dependency or a mental disability is not sufficient to overcome illegal conduct involving moral turpitude, which was found in this matter. This court has also held that disbarment is appropriate.
Yet we found it to be a factor to be considered in the first one where there was illegal conduct going on. Thievery from his firm, from his clients. Those are obviously on par with the crimes of moral turpitude.
Certainly, Your Honor. It's Relator's position that it's partially a cumulative effect. What brings us here today is the respondent's 3.5-year drug conspiracy that resulted in a felony conviction, resulting from him obtaining between 700 to 800 prescriptions for OxyContin, Percodan, and Percocet. During that conspiracy, he lied to his client, Dr. Brodnix, in an attempt to scam him out of $50,000 by telling him that he was under investigation, indictment was imminent, and that he could bribe a state, the respondent could
bribe
a state official.
And at that time, the doctor wasn't under investigation or indictment?
The respondent admitted at the hearing that all of his claims to Dr. Brodnix were false, and in an effort to obtain $50,000 from Dr. Brodnix.
Did the physician eventually get into trouble with the law?
The physician was one of the three co-conspirators that was convicted in this proceeding, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Additionally, and more aggravating in this matter, Your Honor, the respondent realized he could not obtain all of the prescriptions he needed in his own name, or he would have been discovered by law enforcement. So he enlisted the help of his criminal defense clients in obtaining prescriptions, for which he paid some of them. He enlisted the assistance of his law office staff for obtaining prescriptions for him. And when that still was not enough, he used the names of clients without their knowledge or permission to obtain these prescriptions. It's Relator's position that the cumulative effect of all of this misconduct and this court's prior case law, where they found such conduct merited disbarment, is the basis for our request.
But Mr. Berger, didn't we already rule on that? The issue before us today is the felony conviction. The facts that you just recited are what were in the previous suspension,
no.
Correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The prior disciplinary case was based upon the respondent's failure to properly represent 13 clients, his theft of settlement funds from 6 clients, his misuse of his IOLTA account, his failure to cooperate, and making false statements to the two relators in that proceeding. At the time of his disciplinary hearing in the prior disciplinary case in October 2007, the relators were aware that the respondent had a drug addiction problem, but we were not aware of the underlying facts that resulted in his subsequent being charged and being convicted, and they were pled nowhere in any of the disciplinary complaints that were filed by the two relators. I'd like to address a couple of the issues raised by respondent's counsel. He mentioned the respondent's history of service to the community, to the neglected and exploited minority communities, or I'm sorry, to the disadvantaged and minority communities. Relator would just point out these are the same communities that respondent spent several years neglecting and exploiting. The respondent's misconduct, further, we would like to point out, goes far beyond his drug addiction in that he used clients, law office staff, and law clients without their knowledge or permission to obtain his drugs. The respondent has argued that a concurrent suspension is appropriate in this matter. While Relator is nonetheless advocating for disbarment, we would point out in our brief, we've cited several cases which establish when this court has ordered a concurrent suspension, that occurred in circumstances where either there were two cases pending before this court at the same time involving the same attorney, or where there was a subsequent case that involved an additional single ethical lapse of the same type, not the extraordinary additional amount of misconduct.
Counsel, the board recommended a consecutive, did they not?
Yes, a consecutive indefinite suspension. That's correct, Your Honor. Further, relator would point out, in addition to the clients harmed by a respondent in his prior disciplinary case and in his current disciplinary case, there are over 20 additional clients who've received over $200,000 in awards from the Client Security Fund for additional dishonest acts by the respondent.
What are the chances of him paying that back or having any incentive to pay it back if he's disbarred?
Your Honor, I wouldn't be able to speculate as to his ability to pay it in either situation.
But if the repayment is a precondition, and he understands that, to any hope of getting back in, and if that's important to him, and obviously it is, or Mr. Greer wouldn't be here advocating so capably for him, that's an incentive. It's a big incentive for him to undertake efforts to reimburse the funds and any outstanding restitution that's required for clients, the hope that he might someday be able to return to the practice of law. If we take that away, it doesn't seem to me there's much hope for recovering any funds.
Your Honor, it would be relator's position that the hope that respondent would repay has been paid out by the Client Security Fund isn't an appropriate mitigating factor that would reduce his sanction in this proceeding.
Mr. Berger, if I could turn you to our previous case, which was July 9th of 2008. We released that opinion, and we stated at that point at paragraph 74, from evidence of character, reputation, remorse, chemical dependence, recovery efforts, we concluded that there was a case for eventually practicing law again. We found that the addiction severely compromised interests of the clients, the legal system, profession, and the public. But many expressed confidence that he may eventually regain ethical bearings and maintain sobriety. In the next paragraph, we had conditions in accepting the recommendation for indefinite suspension. And those are the first one, that he remain continuously sober during the suspension and comply with the OLAP contract. Do you have anything to tell us about his not complying with that?
Your Honor, what I can tell you is threefold. First, there were no medical professionals or OLAP representatives that testified in the present disciplinary case. So there is no evidence other than that which was provided by other non-medical, non-OLAP
witnesses.
But we
do have a letter from Mr. Moat, do we not, in the materials?
Your Honor, that was attached to a document filed by Respondent's Counsel after the record was closed. Relator would object to that being considered in the evidence in that it was submitted after the evidence was closed. Relator wasn't offered an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Moat. Further, if you read that letter closely, you'll see the statements by Mr. Moat with regard to Mr. Lawson's compliance all come from other people. None of it is firsthand knowledge by Mr. Moat. It is him saying, this person told me this and this person told me that.
Okay, do you have anything to show that he has not done these things?
With regard to his OLAP contract, the respondent testified at the hearing that he had failed to comply with two terms since his release from prison and from the halfway house in September of 2009. In September of 2010. The respondent acknowledged he hadn't had weekly contacts with his OLAP monitor, as required by the contract and as ordered by this court, and the respondent acknowledged he hadn't submitted monthly meeting logs, as required. Further, this is not the first time the respondent has failed to comply with these terms in his contract. During the first disciplinary hearing in October of 2007, in his prior disciplinary case, the respondent admitted that he had failed to comply with those two very same terms for 5 months prior to that hearing. So the respondent, it appears, would like to fashion his own contract with his own terms rather than following what's been ordered by the court or what's been agreed to by him in his OLAP contract.
Was he terminated from an OLAP contract for noncompliance?
There's no evidence in the record with regard to that factor, Your Honor. What I would say is, in the respondent has argued that his voluntary activities with the Hawaii Lawyers Assistance Program are the equivalent. However, the respondent is not under a contract with the Hawaii Lawyers Assistance Program, and he has no obligations to them. He can participate at will, however he wishes. Nobody's monitoring him on a regular basis. He's not submitting reports to demonstrate that he's doing anything. And certainly, someone such as the respondent, who admits he used illegal drugs every day from 2000 to 2007, requires contractual monitoring with somebody keeping an eye on him on a regular basis based upon their terms and desires, not the respondent's.
What about conditions of probation? Is there drug screening and monitoring?
I believe the respondent gave some testimony with regard to that, Your Honor, during the hearing, that it was the respondent's testimony that he did he was subjected to drug testing and that he did pass the drug test.
Okay.
Relator has no evidence that the respondent has abused illegal drugs, just that the respondent hasn't complied with the terms ordered by this court, and it appears to be a pattern of noncompliance in that this is the second time he's failed to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Greer, you have used all of your time. Is there anything additional that we need to know?
Just two things, and I'll try to be brief, and I appreciate the opportunity.
You'll have 30 seconds to do it.
We should not be elevating form over substance. You have the report from Mr. Dixon, who's the head of the Hawaiian comparable OLAP. You have the testimony of Mr. Lawson. He's available for a urine test anytime anybody wants to give it to him.
Does he have a contract now with the Hawaii OLAP, or is it just a volunteer basis?
He is working with Mr. Dixon. He's at the University of Hawaii Law School.
Does he have a contract?
I do not know that he has a formal contract, no. And he, of course, was in a drug program while he was incarcerated. He has followed through with that when he got out.
Thank you.
And I would simply cite the court to its own decisions in Resnick in February and December of last year and in Larkin in February of this year as to where I think the court's views ought to be.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our opinion. Marshal, will you adjourn court?